Welcome to Macro Musings, the podcast series where each week we pull back the curtain and take a closer look at the important macroeconomic issues of the past, present, and future. I'm your host, David Beckworth of the Mercatus Center. We are glad you've decided to join us. Our guest today is Carl Smith. Carl is the Director of Economic Research at the Niskanen Center, where he focuses on public finance, political economy, and monetary policy. He also founded the Media Presence Modeled Behavior. Today, Carl joins us to discuss the rise of market power and what that means for the U.S. economy. Carl, welcome to the show.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
It's good to have you on. We actually go way back in the good old days of blogging. Uh-huh. Well, we still blog occasionally, but we cut our teeth, I believe, in blogging back uh-huh. during the crisis. But tell us and our listeners, how did you get into economics and tell us your journey to the Niskanen Center?
I went to North Carolina State. I was born in North Carolina. I was raised in Greensboro. And I went to North Carolina State mainly to be a student athlete. But when I took my first sort of economics course there, it was Economics 101, I fell in love with it. I took another course. And in fact, I think the first 3 years I was there, I had taken through all the main theory courses of undergrad, and I started on their sort of graduate program. It was an immediate falling in love. I left a little bit to try to make a fortune in the .com industry. For a brief period, I came worked for a company here. I think it was called Talon. That company folded, and then I went to work for Accenture, which is a large consulting firm. And then after just about when it was clear that everything was not going to pan out there, I just went back to graduate school and I finished my graduate degree. I got my PhD. That was actually at NC State, just where I come from. And then I became a professor at the University of North Carolina, UNC, in their School of Government. And so I was there, I don't know, maybe about 5 years, I guess. And during that time, I started model behavior. It actually turned out because the School of Government has like a unique mission. It has a really strong engagement mission. Mm-hmm. And it's actually the advisor to the North Carolina General Assembly that they kind of became a little bit uncomfortable with like some of the stuff that I was doing on model behavior. They thought I was a little bit too sharp. And after some negotiations, they gave me some money to leave. and so I came to DC briefly to try to sell model behavior big time, but I think that was about when blogs were sort of like, there were some of them were getting eaten up, and I had the idea that maybe I would get eaten up by Vox or something else. But that didn't happen. And so I started sort of like an independent consulting for a while. I did some consulting for SRI. I did some consulting for a financial company called Pantheon, and I came to Niskanen. I don't know. That's a long story. I don't know if you really want to hear
it. That's great.
At all, but yeah.
So, yeah, I just the listeners know, I started blogging back in the fall of 2007.
That sounds about when I was in, maybe a little bit after that.
Yeah. I remember you coming on the scenes, modeled behavior. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting is one day I get an email to go to a blogging conference, all paid, mm-hmm. At the Kauffman Center. And at first, this must be a joke. Who pays bloggers to go to conferences? But anyways, you were there. A number of other people were there. And that's where we first met and kept our conversations going. So it's been neat to kind of see you get to the Niskanen Center. Of course, I'm here at the Mercatus Center now. So have a blog. We'll travel. Mm-hmm. Open up doors for us. In addition to the fact that we were already academics doing our own research and stuff along the side. But you've done some interesting work. And model behavior has been great to follow over the years. And some of the work you've been doing recently at the Niskanen Center, some of your writings deals with this big hot topic of market power. And we're going to get into that and as well get into some maybe recent Fed policy, time permitting, on the show. But before we do that, tell us about the Niskanen Center because it's relatively new. Maybe some listeners would like to know more about it.
It's relatively new. Our president, Jerry Taylor, spent, you know, I'm going to probably get the exact details wrong here, but I'm going to say something like 30 years at the Cato Institute. He decided to leave and start his own organization. So he struck out with the Niskanen Center, named after Bill Niskanen, who was one of the founders of Cato. And the idea behind the Niskanen Center was to stay with generally libertarian policy, although we've moved over to what some people might call libertarian after an article that Brink Lindsey wrote, who at the time was a scholar at Cato. I've tried to call it neoliberalism, but I don't know. I want to get into that. I've tried to like hijack this term and use it for us. But basically, it sort of abandons some of the, I guess, deep first principles commitment to libertarianism that Cato has, and has more of a Chicago School of Economics approach to libertarianism. So it's a practical sort of libertarianism, and we think that moves at the margin make a big difference. And so we're not concerned with, like, you know, the grand scheme to sort of sweep away the state, but how to make, you know, the economy more dynamic, how to make it more market focused, how to deal with problems like climate change in the most market friendly way. So that's what we're doing at the Niskanen Center.
Okay. Very pragmatic.
Pragmatic.
Push for more free market solutions. All right. Well, let's get into this question of market power. And to motivate this, you know, I want to bring up some of the recent discussions we're hearing about, we read about a lot. That includes things such as there's fewer startups, we hear often, there's a rise in business concentration, decline in interstate labor mobility, decline in labor share of income, median real wages have fallen, labor force participation rate for males has declined. I just read an article this morning that, you know, companies are getting older, they're aging, mm-hmm. and as a consequence, they're less productive, which is a drag on agro-productivity growth. It's a very depressing kind of collective narrative here you can put together, and it's really, you know, man, mm-hmm. what's happening to us? So you kind of get this impression where either this old man who's sick type of economy, like we're losing dynamism, or there's another story you can tell, which I think we'll get into your take, is that maybe there's some structural changes going on, and we're just misreading these signals. They may look bad on the surface, but the implications, interpretations might be actually more benign, maybe even positive. Before we get into the nitty-gritty of market power, though, I just wanted to kind of step back and ask your take on it. Is this more of a sick man story, all of these indicators we've just mentioned, or is it more of a structural change story?
So I think it's some of both. I mean, okay. I think the loss of dynamism in the economy, or the story you told, is probably central to Niskanen's sort of work and our focus and what we want to examine. And so spent like virtually all the time I'm there thinking about it. And even before I came, Will Wilkinson, some other people spent a lot of time thinking about that. And I mean, what we think is especially with some of the things with the regulatory state, we think that there are what we sometimes call pebbles in the stream, or things that have sort of slowed us down. There are, you know, land use regulations, which I think almost everybody is starting to accept as a big deal. We think that, you know, things like occupational licensing are a big deal. We think that the general sort of predisposition to restrict economic rights, if there is even the sense of a harm or the sense that someone will be put out, that those things do seem to be having some negative effect on the economy. I think also that there is probably, that is related to a deeper structural change that seems to have taken place around 1960. And I think this is a story you're referring to where I talk about that. A lot of what seems to happen is that our drive and sort of pure industrialization in just getting more, you know, more total, like, atoms under our control or molecules under our control for each person, more material stuff, ran into diminishing terms in the 60s because people kind of like had almost as much material stuff as they wanted. What they then wanted were things that were sort of like more tailored to them, more individualized experience. And so there's something that a hypothesis I talk about is that coming out of 1960s, we saw the great variation, where we see instead of just bigger and more, bigger cars, more houses, more products, we see more personalized stuff. So like, you know, what kind of, sometimes like what kind of like homeware like represents me? And this is a different kind of economy that rewards different things. In particular, you're going to need to spend a lot of time developing particular niches in the economy. And that's a sort of capital that's hard to measure, but is as important to producing the experience as our traditional sort of like bricks and mortar capital, as the machines that we've had in the past. And so some of what we're seeing is just heavy, heavy investment in these particular niche experiences to give people I guess, like more of what they want now, not just more stuff, but more stuff that's sort of tailored to me and my, uh, my life. Yeah.
So this story that you're telling is a little bit different, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, than kind of the smart machines are coming in to take over the world story, the second industrial age. That this is a little bit different. You're speaking more towards we all have niches that we want.
Right.
Or maybe the technology has arisen to meet that demand. Are these stories different? Are they complementary?
I think they're somewhat complementary. I mean, one of the things that digital technology has allowed and the way that we've used it is to give us more personalized experiences. So I think everyone sort of identifies the big product to come out of here is smartphones. Well, smartphones are give you your own sort of on-me personal computer, personal view mm-hmm. into the world. And so that's an example of how one of our fastest growing technological areas has split off into giving people personalized experiences. What we don't then just have are bigger and bigger and more powerful computers. And we sort of saw that run out in digital technology too. That, I mean, at first it was just about, more memory, more processing speed. How fast can I possibly get my computer? But then it soon turned, or not soon, but eventually turned into shrinking it down, having it on me all the time, having apps that are exactly the suite that I need and not just, a bigger, more powerful Word version of Word. And that's illustrative of the kind of switch once you get to a certain level of base power towards individualization, towards making it personalized for the individual.
Okay. So there's both structural change that's coming that I believe is coming is really big, driverless cars, uh-huh. smart machines, artificial intelligence. All this is happening, but at the same time, alongside that is this increased product differentiation, this increased niche marketing to people, because it's not just about having a quantity, it's the quality
right.
of life as well. All right, so that's kind of the nice story of all these bad signs that I just went through, the decline in labor income, the concentration of business, fewer startups. That's one possible interpretation. The other one, of course, is that we're the old sick man, the economy, it's stagnating. Uh-huh. And you said there's a bit of both going on, right? So there's some of both, the bad regulations. Uh-huh. Tyler Cowen has the new book out, The Complacent Class. And I had him on the show. And kind of the takeaway I took from that book is that as a whole, our American culture is becoming more risk averse on the margin. And so we see it manifested in regulations that you mentioned, the protection of incumbent businesses, but also the way we raise our kids, helicopter parenting to little things like that, to broad things. Like we couldn't build the Hoover Dam again if we wanted to, just uh-huh. because there's so many regulations. So do you worry that we are becoming more risk averse on the margin generally in our culture? Do you buy into this complacent class?
I do to some extent. And I think that that these two phenomena are sort of related to. So when there was sort of widespread material deprivation, the notion that we could just do more, have more, cure diseases, control the rivers was inspiring to everybody. But as I think we sort of shifted out into our own niches, the great variation or whatever, not messing up my little corner of the world, became more important to people. On just the surface of that, I would say, those are preferences, there's nothing wrong with it. But what you lose, I think, is these sort of spillover effects from dynamism. So one of the things that happens is that as people take risk, as they take chances, they discover new things, and a lot of the benefits of those things don't just accrue to them, but to anybody else in society. So there's a self-reinforcing story of growth that happens when everyone is taking chances. Some people will fail, but the knowledge that they create, even during some of their failures, will help out the next person. And the fact that we've lost that, those sort of dynamic spillovers, I think is disconcerting. And I think that fits with what Tyler's talking about. He's always a little cagey about exactly what yeah. the underlying phenomenon is. But I think our stories are complementary. I think, yeah. His take is a little bit more, I think, is a little bit more pessimistic, and mine is, tends towards the optimistic, but aware of sort of the challenges that this presents us.
Okay. So we've got the two narratives, the sick man story mm-hmm. or the structural change story, which is much more positive. There may be a bit of both of those of actually what's going on. But going back to the phenomenon that people are trying to explain, one of them is the decline in labor share of income. So there's a lot of on the surface bad developments. That seems to be one of the troubling ones. There's been different stories. Again, we could point to these two broad explanations, but some of the explanations given that would fit into those two camps. One would be automation is driving some of that decline in labor income. Another one is globalization. And then I want to mention an article here by David Otter, David Dorn, Lawrence Katt, Christina Patterson, John Van Reenen, 2017 AEA Proceeding article, but their article is concentrating on the fall the labor share. And they basically tell the superstar winner-take-all argument, driven by actually by good firms who are better with technology, more productive firms, they're increasing concentration. So it's there's increasing concentration, they show, but it's because these firms are better than other firms.
Right.
And when you're more productive, higher productivity, you don't need as much labor. You don't need, you know, as many labor inputs because you can do more with the same amount of labor. And they attribute that as one of the explanations. Do you think that's a reasonable story, the superstar?
I think there's some chances that it's part of it. I'm sure you're going to get to it later, but that contrasts a little bit with some of the locker stuff in that, like, where we see seemingly the largest sort of markups over labor costs are not actually in the biggest firms. So there's some obvious examples of super big firms where you see that. I mean, I guess Apple would be the big example mm-hmm. and stuff. But, you know, Amazon is a, you know, zero profit firm. They're pretty large. I think the margins, you know, for Walmart are not particularly large. And so there are lots of very large firms that's clearly used information technology to become dominant in their field and to do things better than everybody else. But they're not necessarily getting a lot of markup over labor cost. And so I'm not sure if that's where the declining share is okay. coming from. Yeah. But
yeah. So it's gotta be more than just that. That's their argument. Presumably more. I guess maybe we should define what is this winner-take-all kind of argument anyways? How would you explain it to the average person?
So what I would say is there are a couple of ways that it works, but like through a variety of things, I think the argument that I like the most is mastery of like information technology. And so even a firm that seems pretty bricks and mortar like Walmart, what they developed sort of in the early 90s was a really strong inventory control. And they had, you know, the little hand scanners everywhere, and the central office knew exactly how much inventory they needed, and they could set up the trucks to be really efficient. They had the warehouse. They had, you know, these legendary warehouses where they're like trucks back up at one end and back up on the other end. They just cross one box, you know, from an incoming truck to an outcoming truck. And they're able to manage all this stuff seamlessly because they had such a strong proprietary IT system. And it costs a lot to build that system. You pay a lot of money to build it. But once you build it, you can scale it up really easily. And because you can scale it up really easily, then you can sort of, if your IT system is the best, you can sort of dominate most of the market. Like no one will be able to compete with you on price. And that's largely like what we saw from Walmart, because like you have this special advantage. So even if, you know, Kmart or someone else is trying to offer the lowest prices, is trying to put pressure on suppliers, they can't quite match exactly what you're doing because you have this IT advantage that you've invested in. And now you can spread it out to all of your stores everywhere across the country.
Yeah, I mean, I think of Amazon as the best example of that, right? I remember when they first came out in the late 90s or mid 90s.
Yeah, about 96, I think, 96. Yeah, started selling books.
And that's all I got was books. Oh, they're mm-hmm. the books. But now they sell everything, right? And they're getting into groceries and they have this advantage, right? This innovation advantage in terms of technology. Okay. And this also applies. I mean, we've heard the superstar effect in terms of people, right? So if you're a musician where you used to have maybe one national market, you got the global market now and it's yours for the taking if you're the one who gets there first. So you can get super rich, super, super big market share gains. It's fascinating.
The billionaire authors, right?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Think of the J.K. Rowling's and others like that. All right. So there's the superstars, one argument, superstar effect for firms is one argument for decline in labor share of income. Another one, I'm mentioning another author here I'm sure you've heard of. I hope I pronounce his name correctly. But Simcha Barkai?
Okay.
He's the one, he had a paper that came out. He was a University of Chicago grad student. I think he's in university in London now. But he argued that the decline in labor share was not offset by a rise in capital share of income, but a rise in profit share.
Right.
Which is kind of an interesting argument. But he goes on and he says the reason this has happened is because markups have gone up. Mm-hmm. And it's not an efficient outcome, which is a nice kind of segue into, you know, drum roll, the paper of the hour. And that is the DeLocher-Eckhart paper, which has really made a lot of headlines. And tell us about that, because they're making the same point about markups being inefficient, being and what's striking about this paper, I'll let you summarize, but one thing I wanted to put in, it tries to explain all these developments, all these phenomena we just described. Mm-hmm. So give us a summary of it and tear it apart for us.
Okay. So I don't know how much you want to go into the methodology, but essentially their argument is this, is if we look at what firms' cost of production is, and they have a slick way of sort of estimating this, and then we look at the prices they charge, we can identify a sort of a markup there. And then over time, this markup has gotten larger and larger and larger. And that is, you know, from a basic economic standpoint, that is a sign of some type of monopoly power. Now, if you think of it as just traditional monopoly power, like, you know, when in Econ 101, there's perfect competition on the one end and monopoly on the other. If you think this represents like traditional monopoly, then what you're seeing is that the reason firms are able to make this markup is because they're actually like restricting production. They're actually producing less than the market would take at the cost, right? So they raise their costs, they sell a little bit less or whatever, and we're missing an efficient allocation because there's somebody who would want to buy it for the cost of production, but they've raised the price. Now, it's actually not just the raising of the price, but the pulling back on production, which allows them to explain all of these phenomena. So that makes everything in the economy, especially labor, less productive than it otherwise could be, because you always are going to be having some form of idle resources. You're not going to do as much capital investment as you could because you're not trying to expand production out to the point where costs are exactly equal to price. And so they go through, and once you've got that, they go through and show that, like, then labor share is going to go down because some of this is going to these extra profits. Productivity is going to go down because you're not investing as much. Once you get productivity going down, then I think you're going to be able to explain what's happened to like wages, what's happened to median income, what's happened to lots of the phenomena that people are worried about throughout the economy. And so their grand explanation is that, like, what we're seeing here is classic monopoly power, and that monopoly power is having these inefficient effects that have spread across the economy and produce misery for everybody. What makes me skeptical of this is a number of things. One is the fact that even when you look at their own data, and they try to talk about this a little bit, it's not actually the largest firms that have the biggest markup. When they split between these, split their analysis at one point between very large firms and sort of smaller firms. And the very large firms seem to have like almost a constant markup across from like the 60s, where we think that the economy is working in its like classical, strong productivity push mode, all the way to 2015 or whenever their last data set is. It's pretty constant. What we've seen is there are smaller firms which have had a much larger markup. So that's one clue about what's going on. The other is that they're not telling, or there's nothing in there that talks about like contestability. And I think for economists like, and exactly for how I think about it, this is the big test of monopoly. It's not how large you are. It's not even how high your profits are, but it is whether or not you're afraid of other entrants into the market, whether or not other people can come in and try to compete away the monopoly profits that you have. Because if they can't, then we're in a world that's something more like monopolistic competition, which is a model some people learned in the middle. And the thing about monopolistic competition is you still have markups, you still have price above minimum average costs. But what that's rewarding, what that's paying for, is the specialization that the firm had to do to get its particular niche market. And as long as the profits are higher than what it costs to like to build your brand or to build your special product, then you're going to see competitors come in and offer rival brands. And I mean, that looks like a lot of what we see like in the modern world. So you have, if you have like, you know, Apple doing really well, you know, Samsung comes in and tries to offer, you know, an alternative. In fact, and this sort of like falls into this story, is like early on in the smartphone revolution, you had a huge number of competitors, right? There are all kinds of phones operating on Android system. There are some phones operating on Windows system. There are some phones operating on things like Symbian system. I think BlackBerry tried to come up with a system. I think Palm was trying to hang in there. And most of them couldn't do it. And I think the reason why they couldn't do it is because they weren't producing, you know, their product, despite their enormous amount of investment in information technology and attempting to offer the best product. They just couldn't get, they lost out to Apple. They lost out to Samsung. And for a while there, I think like Samsung and Apple had something like 115% of all the profits in the phone market because everyone else combined was making losses. So what that sort of tells us is that they were investing heavily in order to sort of chase these profits, investing so heavily that when they sold, you know, the number of phones they sold couldn't make up for it. And so what we have coming out with this sort of like, seemingly market split between, Samsung and Apple is the result of a fiercely competitive process that's driven forward the technology. That's exactly the opposite of what we think of in classical monopoly. Think of a classical monopolist as sitting on their hands, as not investing, as not looking towards the future, as just sort of soaking up the privilege of being the only player in town.
So there's a benign form of market power or monopoly power. And just to maybe keep it real simple for people out there who may not have all the economic, you know, training that we do, market power basically is the ability to change your price without losing all your customers, right? So and monopolists is the extreme example that they can increase their price and there's no one else who competes with them. And maybe even they try to keep out the competitors, the evil standard. I mean, the example in the textbook would be evil Standard Oil, which even that's not a clear cut case. But that's kind of like you think of this evil monopoly villain who keeps out competition, jacks up price, and you have no choice but to go to them. But what you're arguing is there's something less than that where people are willing to pay more, willing to allow these firms to have market power because they value something unique, something different. And you use the term monopolistic competition, which defines maybe a large part of what we're talking about here. So can you give an example of a monopolistically competitive firm and what is it that we value about these firms?
Okay, so I think one of my favorite examples, because it shows how you can make a lot of profit, how you can grow really big, but how you have to stay on your game, is Chipotle. So they're not in the tech space, and it's hard to see whether or not information technology and stuff was a big player in there, but they created sort of a unique product experience that people loved. They expanded rapidly. Their stock price went up. They made enormous amounts of profit. But they had an E. coli incident. They lost a bunch of customers, and they've never recovered since. And that's important because what you see is that you have this innovation that provides people with a much different experience that they want. But unless the company continually reinvests in sort of making sure everything about their customer experience, and I think that's really what monopolistic competition is about, is the customer experience, that their customer experience is good, they're going to lose that very market power. They're going to lose what we might think of as brand power, the desire of people to say, here I get this special experience at Chipotle. And so they got a little bit ahead of themselves, you know, in details of it, but they fell to the wayside. And so we see this sort of like spinning or this ability of churn to happen for new competitors to come in and for old competitors to be pushed out. I think I want to kind of make a point though is that like, I'm not purely sort of like a Pollyannish about like what's going on. My main thing is that it's complicated, and then we have to think about it. So here, there's certainly lots of monopolistic competition going on. Some of that seems to be about innovating special customer experiences, but some of it may be maybe more harmful. And this is the kind of example that I think of. So like the urban restaurant market is really popular now. People like their Ethiopian restaurants. They like lots of variation. And so they get higher prices for urban restaurants. But where much of this becomes capitalized is not in, investing in new forms of food and stuff, but is in rental prices for the restaurant. The rents in the areas where you have this dense concentration of restaurants goes higher and higher and higher. And part of the reason it goes higher is because there are land use restrictions that won't allow sort of the commercial area, the area in which we're selling restaurants, to expand. And that is a more sort of, that is a more costly form of restriction. And we still would see the same sort of markups. We still would see the same sort of increase of price. But instead of us having like the extra money going to investing in innovation, it's just going to rent for landlords. And so even if all of this is inspired by an attempt to provide specialty experiences, how those experiences are produced and whether or not they're contestable is a thing that we have to look at. Are new entrants able to get into the market and provide like alternatives, innovative things? Do the current entrants have to keep spending their profits on innovation or not? And that, rather than simply looking at size or even profitability, is sort of the metric that that I want to focus on.
All right. I like the Chipotle example. One, I love eating there. But two, I think it's a good example in the sense that people are willing to pay a little bit more to go to Chipotle, say, over Taco Bell.
Right.
Because there's an experience, the food, the ambience, the environment that they're willing to pay this extra amount for.
Right.
And that's going to be that the markup is that added profit they get because I'm willing to pay for that experience. And what you're showing, I think it's a great example, is they had a bad E. coli experience and suddenly I'm going back to Taco Bell or maybe some other comparable.
Panera.
Yeah, some other, above Taco Bell level. But the thing is, they have to be careful, right? That margin, that profit margin is not guaranteed. Where we think of a true monopoly, it's a little more, it's not guaranteed, it's a little safer. But Chipotle, they will lose it. They will lose a big part of their market share if they're not careful. Now, I guess my question is, so what I think I'm hearing you say is that there's been a big rise in monopolistic competition since.
I think so.
Okay, so why did it start when it did, and then what enabled it?
And so I would go back to, you know, my sort of story about like industrialization.
Okay.
That up to, I mean, I think this is the sort of the baseline cause of it. Is it in the generation that came through after the 1950s into the 1960s, was one of the first ones where what we would think of as pure material deprivation was like unknown to a significant portion of the middle class, where people basically, you were definitely going to have enough to eat, you're definitely going to have a house, you're going to definitely have enough clothes. So that what we think of as material deprivation wasn't there. And it was in this moment in history that we also sort of saw this big push towards sort of counterculture, this big push away from materialism. And sometimes people are like, it exhausted that journey, and they were looking for something else, looking for something specialized. One of the things stories I like to joke about, just to give people a sense of how pervasive this pattern was, is I think by some scientific measures said like lollipop, you know, lollipop, lollipop. So like the catchiest song possible by using mathematical algorithms. And in fact, music in the late 50s, they had like, you know, scientists come in, they had people like sort of test these and do focus groups and all that sort of stuff to see, oh, what's the catchiest thing you could possibly do? So you do that. But then people run into a thing of like, well, they want something like more, you know, authentic. That's not really me. I mean, it's catchy and sure, and everybody loves it, but one of these is me. And so you have a push away from that, you know, folk music or, you know, like, you know, different types of rock or things that are like, that are much more sort of like individualized and pushing back against the larger culture. And so this is sort of expanded out, like, you know, this sort of originally counterculture, but then counterculture became the dominant culture. So then it's sort of like just, what we think of as, affluent and near affluent Americans desire to have like specialty, you know, sort of like specialty experiences. And it's bleeding further and further down the chain. I mean, you can see even now, so if we stay within restaurants, that McDonald's is like, you know, was our classic sort of, you know, 1940s, you know, just build more restaurants, build, you know, faster, cheaper restaurants, is in financial trouble and trying to find any way they can to offer you like these deluxe, sriracha, you know, whatever kind of experience they can to keep customers, even customers that are going down in, you know, when we go down the income scale there, as opposed to, you know, searching for another sort of specialized experience. Just the fact that they can give you, you know, a cheap cheeseburger is not enough anymore. And it's not enough for a larger and larger portion of the population. And so that's where we see this sort of like total switch to monopolistic competition, because we sort of exhausted just getting over material deprivation.
Okay. So you're telling a story which is benign, even I'd say maybe even good. We get more product variety as consumers, which we value. People like Noah Smith have pushed back against this. He has said, oh, but monopolistic competition, there's a level of inefficiency because there are some idle resources. It's, you know, there is that profit margin. It's not doing as much as one could. But your pushback, I think, is, but what that ultimately gives us is all this variety, right? And he tends to overlook that point.
I think so. And I mean, like, so in the strictest sense, monopolistic competition doesn't push firms to produce at minimum total cost, right? Minimum average total cost. They're not as purely cost cutting, you would think of that, as is a perfectly competitive firm. And so in a very technical way, they're not as efficient. But what that extra cost is paying for, what the price over cost is paying for, is the development of this particular brand. I mean, that's exactly what comes out of the model. And so if you were to think about just pushing the entire economy to perfect competition, then you would just get like lots of all the same, you know, widgets, but they would be really, really cheap. So everybody has the same couch, everybody has the same this, you know, all the cars look the same, which is, you know, what was a period in the U.S. history where it seemed to be going in that direction. But I don't think that's the future that most people sort of envision or think is best. You know, there's more to life than just the total massive consumption that you can have. The variety or the quality of it makes a big difference. And I think Noah overlooks that some. And I think part of it is because he's kind of like upset about about something that's largely starting out like, you know, like upset about what the possibility of market power. And so he's very sensitive to any sort of possibility of inefficiency. Yeah.
So I want to again tie this back up to the macro level. This is macro musings after all. But what we've been talking about here this past few minutes has been an explanation for the rise in the markup, you know, price above the marginal cost of production. So this is an explanation, a benign explanation for that phenomenon. But there's still a host of other things going on that are more troubling. Business concentration, income inequality, stagnant real median wages. But are those separate issues explained by other developments, or are they related to this monopolistic competition story that you're telling?
I think they may be related. So one of the things that you're going to see in the monopolistic competition story is that returns are going to come not just from even just like providing labor, but providing labor that is able to produce these types of experiences. And so through base industrialization, you know, I mean, we have a classic story of moving from like farm to city, from agriculture to the factory. And really, you just need to be like a person on the floor who can like follow the basic routine and instructions to do it. And there's an enormous demand for that labor. It's way more productive than it was in the agricultural sector. And so you see both productivity and wages rising together. As you get out into a more monopolistically competitive story, as you get out into a story that's about varieties, then where the bang for the buck comes from is, are you able to using creativity or using skills or specialized skills, produce one of these particular experiences? And so all throughout, you know, the entire like labor market, what we're seeing are like increasing returns to skill. And we're seeing ever more increasing returns to people who can sort of develop something new. And so like exactly what you're talking about is not just superstar firms, but superstar individuals, superstar workers who can add something to the value of their firm. So I think this even goes through in tech. You know, there was an economist, I think, a piece that said Google said that their best engineers are 300 times more valuable to them than the average engineer. And if you see that, if you have someone who, for whatever reason, is super sharp, able to write these programs, and that produces an enormous amount more value. You're also going to see that to someone who's even able just to create like a more specialized retail experience. Someone who's, you know, has, you know, is setting the right like ambiance and setting the right mood. So even those types of skills are going to be more valued than just sort of like brute sort of force, you know, showing up to work and lifting boxes sort of skills.
Okay. What does that imply then about someone's education, their career? What would you recommend then in this type of environment? Do you want to be a, do you want to be that superstar, or at least working your way toward that? What, how would you encourage a young person today moving forward?
Well, I don't know if my, my advice is that different. Is that different than the mainstream? But what I would say is that like there's every indication that like this preference for specialized skills is going to continue. And so going into a field that allows you to develop that, or allows you to maximize that, is going to be, going to have a lot more return. And the more sort of like specialized education you can have, the higher your return is going to be. I think that's sort of like the baseline. Based on explanation. And I mean, I think we do see this, like, there are particular things that you can study that kind of like allow you to create things. And so, like, the most obvious example of this is like computer science. So, like, computer science, like, empowers a single individual to like actually, you know, like to create this program, to build this program. So we do see enormous returns there. We still see very large returns in engineering. You know, engineering salaries are still going up. And there you're talking about building things. If you have sort of like specialized marketing skills, so like statistics is big now. Statistics is sort of about finding, you know, the patterns, the particular patterns, uncovering, things that other people might have missed. So all that is about, you know, specialization, creativity, being able to do things that are new and different instead of just replicating like what's already been done on a larger scale.
So this development values creativity.
Yeah.
I mean, pattern recognition, but also taking that data and turning it into something new, entrepreneurial. I mean, being entrepreneurial. In your own way, in your own field. All right. Well, this is a very fascinating discussion, and I could go on for a long time with this, but I do want to move into another area. We're going to switch gears here, talk about something else that you write about, and that is monetary policy, Fed policy, which is my real wheelhouse. But I'm always glad to learn from you about markups and market power. So one of the big issues before us now is going to be, who will President Trump appoint to the Board of Governors? Who will he appoint Fed chair? And by the time this comes out, maybe this will have been made clear. But there are a number of open seats, and then the Fed position is open. Just today, there's a Bloomberg article that came out that says Trump aides deliver him a shortlist of Fed candidates. Dun, dun, dun. I think these names have been floated already, but Kevin Warsh, Janet Yellen, Jerome Powell, Gary Cohn, John Taylor are the ones on that shortlist. What are your thoughts about that shortlist, and who would you like to see as Fed chair moving forward?
Well, on the short list, you know, I think that, you know, I'm okay with Janet Yellen. I think that would probably be my fair, you know, my pick off of that list. You know, I had like a dream sort of draft, you know, Greg Mankiw, movement at a time, but he was a never Trumper. So I don't think that he's ever going to make any of those lists. What sort of has sort of concerned me is, the ascendancy of Kevin Warsh. Kevin Warsh, there are a couple of things. I mean, he was, a lawyer by training and, an employee at Morgan Stanley, you know, an executive at Morgan Stanley by experience. And inherently there's nothing wrong with that. I don't think that everybody on the Fed necessarily has to be an academic. But, on his previous tenure in the Fed, he's shown, at least, you know, from my perspective, a lack of sort of appreciation or understanding of monetary policy, and instead has been like keen to sort of invoke, some of the kind of explanations that you hear, like on CNBC or sometimes out of Wall Street people, that like the economy only suffers from like structural problems, or the Fed getting into the economy, you know, only screws up with, you know, relative prices. And this sense, I mean, one of the arguments that he made at one time was that like the Fed shouldn't do everything it can to bring down, unemployment, because that just takes the fiscal government or the fiscal side off the hook. And I mean, and that's a perspective that is just radically different than I think what we've learned in monetary policy, you know, over the last, you know, since really the Great Depression, that the Fed is the line of first defense, that its ability to stabilize the economy is extremely powerful, you know, if it's motivated, and that rather than, you know, fiscal authorities, you know, messing with the economy or worrying about like particular structural issues, that providing a baseline of steady growth, you know, I like in GDP, but steady growth in nominal demand, really helps to smooth that all, you know, smooth out these frictions and gives a playing field that, market participants can respond to and make optimal decisions. So,
yeah. You know, what's interesting to me is to look back at the past two Fed chairs, Ben Bernanke, Janet Yellen. In some ways, they were textbook folks to take that position, right? Ben Bernanke kind of, you know, the great scholar, the great academic. He wrote on the Great Depression, so it was well timed they came in for the Great Recession. He also wrote on Japan's weak economy. Janet Yellen had been on the Board of Governors. She'd been president of the San Francisco Fed. Mm-hmm. And you know, Ben Bernanke came in and like, well, who better a person to ask? And, you know, and the Fed did prevent us, you could argue, from going into a Great Depression again. But there's also a lot of critique of what Ben Bernanke did. Ben Bernanke, the central banker, is a little bit different than Ben Bernanke, the academic, right? So we had these great hopes, and you could say things could have been worse, but things could have been a whole lot better too. I remember a similar event with Janet Yellen. Janet Yellen came on, and I, of all things, had gotten this Twitter exchange with Justin Wolfers once. I was, you know, just randomly walking in Walmart in rural Kentucky, and I got in this big exchange with, he was super stoked about Janet Yellen, you know, like, she's the best thing since sliced bread, you know, because she's got all the qualities, all the qualifications, and she's done a decent job. But you can also point to the fact that inflation has persistently undershot its target, and it remains a mystery, a puzzle. You know, and it shouldn't be to central bankers. I mean, if the Fed can't figure out inflation, then, which is one of its core jobs, then it makes you wonder. So all I'm saying is this, is that even the best people you can put out there oftentimes aren't perfect, right? Mm-hmm. And sometimes, you know, maybe they adapt to the institution themselves. So I wonder, even if Kevin Warsh were appointed, how long would those Wall Street views last? Would he conform to the, you know, Paul Krugman has called the Fed the Borg collective. You come in, you're assimilated, right? So I'm wondering, you know, to what extent would he be assimilated, or do you think those views would be persistent enough? Also, given the fact that the FOMC is so wide open in terms of staff, it could vastly change the nature of the Fed.
So I'll say this in a couple different ways. So if I just had to do a sort of like detached analysis of it, I would bet that like, the staff at the Fed would make a concerted effort to assimilate him, and that effort would be at least somewhat successful.
Okay.
Now, the fear is that like we're in a time where we have very low interest rates around the world, where we need unconventional monetary policy, and the what we've seen with Ben Bernanke and Janet Yellen is that they had a deep understanding. They had an appreciation for the fact that radical measures based on not traditional monetary practice, but a fundamental understanding of the way monetary policy works might be necessary. But they were sort of constrained by the bureaucracy in the Fed. The bureaucracy in the Fed seems to be very risk averse, seems to be very concerned about doing anything unusual, something that they could be criticized for from Congress, from members of the financial community. And that almost sort of exacerbates the Kevin Warsh problem, because he's one of the people who has been the most critical, the outside voices, from doing non-standard things that go along with our understanding of monetary theory to deal with the particular circumstances of this crisis. And so, for example, when the Fed had to engage in QE, a lot of people on Wall Street had like conniptions about this, and, you know, predicted that there was going to be massive inflation. Kevin Warsh, I think, even came out at a time when inflation was 1%, unemployment was, I think, 9 or 10%, and sort of sided with the Wall Street people that this was too much. This was too interventionist. We shouldn't be pushing the economy as fast because we're just going to have runaway inflation. And, the way that the economy, or sorry, the way that QE was going to work seemed to be completely escape his analysis. And so I worry that that mentality is going to be like combined with sort of the natural conservatism of the Fed to prevent sort of any, you know, like anything unusual from happening. And that's very dangerous if we get into another crisis, right? So, I mean, if we have another large sort of shock to the economy, we have almost no room to move on interest rates. We're probably going to require something, unconventional. I think both you and I, you know, for a long time have been looking towards like more, you know, deeper structural changes, some move to like a NGDP targeting system or something like that. That seems like the farthest thing from somebody like, Kevin Warsh's mind. And I, given his previous statements, and sort of like the confidence and, you know, I don't want to say, but I guess we'll say arrogance or what they had with it. I'm worried about a Fed that just, you know, continues to blame everyone else in the economy and says that they're doing all they can when they're really not exploring the possibilities that we've already laid out, you know, as a result of the Great Recession.
So it sounds like you're worried that we might get an ECB at
time. You might get the Fed. You might
Trichet,
get an ECB.
War should be the new Trichet.
Exactly. Okay. And I mean, and the experience of, you know, of the European economy in the wake of the Great Recession was significantly worse than ours, right? So I think where there was a time, I don't know if I'm going to get my dates exactly right, around maybe 2009 or 2010, when both of our economies were in the 9 or 10% unemployment range. But the Fed took much more immediate and drastic steps, and unemployment in the United States has marched down to about 4%. It kept climbing in Europe to up to about 12% and didn't come down. I don't remember exactly when they started their extraordinary measures, but it might have been 12 or 13. It was a number of years later, and the experience of the worst countries in Europe was horrific throughout that. So the monetary shock on what was called the periphery countries like Greece, Italy to a little bit lesser extent, but nonetheless in southern Italy was worse in some cases than what they experienced during the Great Depression.
So your concern is having something like that happen with Warsh. So fair enough. Let's go then to the inflation puzzle, right? So inflation's been below the Fed's explicit target of 2%. I always, you know, remind my listeners that the Fed was implicitly targeting 2% before. Then, a number of studies have shown this. So, if you keep that in mind, then it's been really since. And if you discount the Great Recession period itself, because you know a lot of things were going crazy that time. If you start from the recovery mid 2009 to the present, the Fed's core PCE deflator's preferred measure of inflation is averaged to 1.5%. So full 50 basis points below its target. I mean that's a long haul. That's persistent and systematic. And I get tired of hearing these one-off stories, right? These one-off. So Janet Yellen gave a recent speech where she tried to explain why they've been below target for so long, at least since 2012. And she has a model she puts in the paper and a nice chart that explains it. And she shows there's three things. There's slack, which maybe they've underestimated the amount of slack. Also, though, she explains a lot of this miss to energy prices and then also import prices. All right. But the thing is, those latter two things, I would argue, are also indirectly affected by what the Fed does. In particular, we know commodity prices, oil in particular, fell dramatically about mid-2014. And what's interesting, Ben Bernanke has a post on this and James Hamilton has a post on this where they do a little model and they estimate that about half of that was due to weak aggregate demand, not just excess. There was excess supply. And then you can tie that back into what the Fed about that time was talking up the dollar, talking up rate hikes. The dollar got stronger, which then led to this decline in commodity prices. So the Fed itself has some indirect influence on at least part of the collapse in commodity prices, which drove down inflation. The second thing is import prices. Well, what affects import prices? The strength of the dollar. And they talked up rate hikes. They see the dollar going up. So my point is this, is if you step back, many of the one-off things or the external things like, oh, it's the strong dollar or it's energy prices are in fact indirect consequences of Fed policy itself. So I'm on a soapbox here preaching, but I guess my question is, how do you evaluate this persistent miss? And why does the Fed seem to keep looking for answers at other places than at itself?
So the basic model I have in my head about why this is happening is that even though 2% is their target, their sort of response to misses to that target seem to be non-symmetric. At least everyone perceives it to be non-symmetric. They talk about it like it's non-symmetric. They create expectations that it's non-symmetric, even though their official line is that it is. Just as you said, when there's any indication that we may overshoot 2%, the Fed is very concerned about getting ahead of it, getting ahead of the inflation. That talks up the dollar, talks up other things. Well, naturally, if you think that like you're okay with missing to the downside, but you're not okay with missing to the upside, then when random shocks come through, right, the ones that put you to the downside are going to play out, but the ones that put you to the upside are not, because market participants are going to expect you to respond to those things. And so the dollar will change or other factors in the economy will change, and you're going to end up consistently slightly below whatever your target is, simply because you've eliminated variation on the top. But you have an eliminated variation on the bottom. So you're going to like sort of wiggle along the bottom. That's my basic model. I mean, I'm open to talking about other things. But that's very simple. And it looks like matches the data, matches what's happening. It also matches sort of what seems to be the disposition of the Fed staff, which is to be conservative, right? So here is this inflation target. High inflation is what people think of as being negative, is what members of Congress are going to think of as being negative. And so they're much more concerned about going over the 2% limit or 2% target and then facing that scrutiny, facing the accusation that they're not holding prices steady, then they are concerned about going under the target. And they are concerned about this sort of persistent missing to the bottom, because that's something that like members of Congress can like more easily get on them about. So I think that that's really what's going on there. And I don't mean to think that they're just so weak or cowardly, that they're just cowering before Congress. But a sort of institutional mentality can get set in when you have this threat on one side, and then everybody just sort of kind of has an understanding that whoa, you know, that's bad. And without even setting an official new policy, you've set an unofficial policy because of your differing level of concern about going over versus going under.
So okay. Yeah, well, that seems reasonable. I mean, at the end of the day, the Fed is a political institution created by an act of Congress, and it has to be mindful of the political environment in which it operates.
I don't know if we're out of time, but I would just say that is actually one of the advantages of a level target, and especially a level target and something that is a little bit more neutral. Like, you know, I know we've always talked about NGDP. Is it like then? You have the perceived responsibility for making up for misses on both sides, mm-hmm. and consistent misses that's going to, you know, put you further and further away. And you have a target which seems both good to the seems negative to miss both to the bottom and to the top. Unlike inflation, you know nobody just wants, you know, nominal GDP to be low. That sounds bad, you know. And so I think that it'd be more likely that we wouldn't be stuck in this regime.
So is it a Kennan Center's official position that they endorse nominal GDP level targeting? Or is that the Carl Smith official position?
So, I mean, it's hard to say. I mean, I'm the economic director there, so it kind of gets to be there. We haven't like come out with that, but I mean, I think we're leaning towards that, and I mean, it might be.
Well, you know, the Niskanen himself was an advocate of it. So he in fact was one of the early people at the Cato Institute that promoted it. So, all right, I think with that, our time is up. Our guest today has been Carl Smith. Carl, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Macro Musings is produced by the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. If you haven't already, please subscribe via iTunes or your favorite podcast app. And while you're there, please consider rating us and leaving a review. This helps other thoughtful people like you find the podcast. Thanks for listening.